Blog Talk Radio.
CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, private investigator, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, on top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live chat, interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member who would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan has the night off, and Gene Cervantes of Citizens Against Homicide will be with us for the entire hour.
Well, Denny, good evening. Our first story tonight that we're going to cover is the case of Joseph Ross. Joey Ross was stabbed to death on July 5th, 2006, while he was walking home around midnight from a bar, The Dugout. It's a sports bar in Oakdale, California. Joey and a friend opened that bar in March of 2004. Now, the previous night, July 4th, the bar was closed in recognition of the holiday. Early on the evening of July 5th, 2006, Joey and a roommate, Steve Olives, went to the bar to play pool, listen to the jukebox, and have a few drinks. Joey had only known Steve Olives for a short time, Joey was helping Steve by letting him stay at his apartment until Steve's job with a local construction company resumed. Now, we know that sometime after midnight, the two men started walking home from the bar. During their departure, they became separated. Later, Steve arrived at the apartment, and subsequently, Joey was found murdered. Joey Ross was 28 years old at the time of his death. Joining us to discuss Joey's case tonight are his parents, Nancy and Bob Ross, and with us is also Lieutenant Lester Jenkins of the Oakdale Police Department. I'd like to open up the questioning by asking Nancy or Bob to tell our listeners something about your son. Please share with us his background, his personality.
Joey was a sports enthusiast. He was good in basketball and baseball, and that's what he always dreamed of having as a sports bar, and that's what he hoped that this dugout bar would become eventually, as a restaurant sports bar, you know, place like that. And he was basically a very shy person, and so we helped him. We thought that his endeavor into this bar business would help bring him out a little more, make him a little more
outgoing
and able to speak with people. And
you assisted he and his friend in establishing the bar.
Right, and then after a while, their partnership kind of had some problems, so the one partner left, and we assumed ownership with Joey, and we ran it with him for about 2 years.
Okay, and then the bar was ultimately sold in November of 2006,
right.
I understand it.
And at the time of his death, we had it for sale. Bob was retired and I was retiring that June. I was a teacher, and we just decided that we'd all needed to move on and do something different. So it was for sale at the time of Joey's death.
All right. Now, I'd like to go right to the timeline of events for this evening. What time did you last speak to your son before he went to the bar that night? Did you speak to him early in the evening?
Oh, yeah, on several times. He called to say that he and Steve were going down there, and I believe I even gave him a ride at one point down there. And and then throughout the night he called and he told me some things like that. The money was all out of the cash register, but there was a $50 bill underneath the tray, and he called and told me that he had taken the $50 bill, and I think they went and bought Red Bull and something at the liquor store that was nearby, and they were using the money in the jukebox or something. He called to ask if that was okay, and sure, fine. And then, of course, right before his death, we had the three calls.
Can you elaborate on that a little? You know, it's now what, midnight, and you begin to get a call from him.
Well, it was probably closer to like 12:30 or so. I mean, the calls came one right after the other, with the last one being somewhere around 12:45 or 12:50, something like that. And the first call, he was just, you know, calling to check in, and it didn't sound concerned about anything. Then the second call, he called and was a little more anxious, mentioned having seen a windshield broken, and there was a used car lot on the way home. But he kept hanging up. I couldn't get any information out of him. And then the last call, he called and said, please come get me, and told me where he was, and something about calling the police. And I said, well, call the police if you're concerned. And
he did make a call to the 911.
He did make a call to 911, but I guess it didn't go through.
Okay.
So,
if I could just ask you to hold on there for 1 second.
Sure.
And I'd like to go right out to Lieutenant Lester Jenkins of the Oakdale Police Department. And Lieutenant, could you give us a thumbnail sketch of the initial police response to this request from Joey, and then perhaps segue into the investigative efforts. I'd be interested in hearing about the telephone pinging, if you had any, if there was any CCTV camera footage from any of the area there. Lieutenant?
Yes, and actually we weren't aware of anything until the following morning at shortly after 5:30.
Uh-huh.
And we received a call from a subject that lived down the street, and he reported finding a body. That was where we began our involvement. So the 911 call did not come through for whatever reason.
Okay. All right,
Tom.
Yes.
I just want to interrupt for just a second. We do have a couple of callers on the line from the 209 area code, and as soon as you wrap up the opening round, we'll take those calls to see if anybody has anything to add to the case. We may, in fact, get some tips. So as soon as you're clear of your opening and your introductory comments from everybody, I'll go ahead and put the callers on and see what they have to say.
Okay. Nancy or Bob, do you have anything that you'd like to add to this initial review?
Not that I can think of. There were some, as the investigation went on, there were some videotapes that, and Lieutenant Jenkins can probably speak to that, from some of the businesses along the way, but the most important one, the USA gas station, I think there was some kind of a problem, and that was probably where he was murdered, right across the street. And there was something that it didn't take, the lights or something.
Yeah,
wrong.
The lights were flashing into the camera, and they couldn't see out the windows. But anyway, that's about all we have up until his death.
Okay. Nothing with the telephone technology?
The telephone technology fizzled on us when they sent it out to have the phone analyzed, and that came back negative on whatever efforts.
Okay. All right, I heard Vito. Yep.
Yeah, just one quick question before Denny goes to the callers there. Hi, Lieutenant. Thank you for being on the show. I have my police hat back on again as a former detective, and two things jump out at me. Number one, sir, when the two boys were walking home, supposedly, during this time they became separated. I think if I'm the detective in charge across the table, I got to look at this Olives guy and say, okay, we're not five-year-old kids. How did you get separated? Explain to me thoroughly how you separated, number one. And number two, you know, obviously Steve Olives leaves town the day after the funeral. Now, you know, I mean, one thing I learned in the police academy many, many years ago, and I've said it on this show and TV all the time, when a person shows improper actions and emotions for the circumstance, and that definitely jumps out at me. I mean, this is your roommate. This is a guy that took you in, tried to help you, and now the day after the funeral, I'm out of here. I mean, can you touch on those two things about why they became separated and what was his feeling about leaving town?
Yes, sir. I can about the first one, at least. The first one, they actually left the bar. It appears they left the bar at slightly different times. It doesn't appear, from what we can tell, it doesn't appear that they were both leaving the bar at the same time. As to an earlier question, we did go to several stores, banks, etc., ATMs, and gather up all the video we could. And we did gather video at a 7-Eleven convenience store that showed a person, probably Mr. Olives, making several phone calls there at between 1 and 2. So as far as leaving town, Mr. Olive stated something to the effect that he was getting a check.
Workman's comp, yeah.
Yes, that was owed to
settlement.
Him. And he was expecting to pick that up the following day in Stockton, which I think is his normal stomping grounds. He was only in our area, I think, temporarily. But that again doesn't change. There's many, many things about him that makes him still probably our top person of interest in this case.
All right. Thank you, Lieutenant, very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Okay, I'm going to jump to the phone now. And, Gene, as soon as we address our phone callers, I want to get to you at the other side. The first one, both are from area code 209. The first one, the first three digits are 324. Caller from 324, you're on the line. Go ahead, please. 324? Okay, apparently he doesn't or she does not want to talk with us right now. We'll go to the next one. The first three digits are 602. 602, caller, you're on the line. Are you there? 602? Okay, both of them apparently decided to hang up. You're welcome to call back if you would like. Gene Cervantes, would you please tell us about when the Citizens Against Homicide became involved in the case and your thoughts?
Yeah, Nancy emailed us and got in contact, and because it's a short program, I won't go. I'll just give you the Reader's Digest version. We talked. We did I did a bunch of phone calls and what have you, and then we ended up talking to the chief of police, Marty West, and got a $50,000 reward from the governor, and ended up getting a billboard also that was put up, and in spite of the $50,000 reward, no one has come forward, and I'm really surprised, because they're undoubtedly, and you know, anybody in the law enforcement knows that you know, people who do something like the person who did this to Joey, you know, they talk, and somebody knows something. And $50,000 reward is quite a bit of money, and I'm just beside myself as to why no one has bothered to come forward. And we're gonna keep trying and sticking with the Rosses and seeing whatever we could do to help solve this case, bring justice for Joey.
I'm wondering, perhaps you know, Gene, or maybe we need to talk to Mr. or Mrs. Ross. But how does anybody know how Joey met Steve? Where did they meet at, or how long they known each other, or that type of thing?
No, I don't. You know, go ahead, Nancy. I'm sorry.
Steve worked at a construction company that was doing some underground work in Oakdale that summer, and well, spring and summer, and they met through there. They were working right in front of the bar, and he came into the bar a few times. And then what happened was he got pulled over in his vehicle, and he had a prior warrant or something, and he ended up it wasn't anything violent or serious, but he ended up going to jail for a period of time. And when he got out, he had nowhere to go because he had given up his apartment and everything, waiting for this workman's comp settlement. And that is when he came, and Joy took him in. And
so they weren't like
no.
in school together, growing up together,
no.
type of thing.
No, they were more acquaintances. And
okay.
Steve really seemed to not have any type of family or anything. And Joey was the type of person that he'd give you the shirt off his back, and you know, he let him stay there.
Did Joey indicate to you at any point what his relationship was like with Steve? I mean, was everything seemed to be pretty smooth?
Everything seemed to be okay. At one point, Joey was talking to me on the phone, and Steve came in and made like a loud noise, and he told me, and I heard him say, "Hey, I'm talking to my mom," and we were talking about something real serious. His cousin was real ill, and he told me later that sometimes Steve would come and like sneak up on him and try to scare him really bad. And the other thing that was real unusual about Steve would never go like down to the bar when all the friends went down or anything. He kind of just like hid out. And when I asked Joey, "Why won't Steve go down, you know, and play pool with you or whatever you're doing?" he said, "Oh, he feels bad because he doesn't have any money." So I don't know, you know.
Okay, how old is Steve in
relation? He was probably a year younger than Joey.
Roughly the same age then.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try one more time. I show these same two calls back
on.
Okay. Hopefully they are there this time. Caller, for first three digits of 602, are you with us? Caller from first three digits of 324, are you on the line with us?
Do they know to press the number one button on the phone?
I would hope that's in the instructions. Well, I'm still getting no answer, so I'm going to disconnect from them.
Oh, there it is. That's
okay, I'll pass the baton for the next questioner.
All right. So, Lieutenant, what's the long term investigative objective here? Where are you headed, and how could the public help you with this $50,000 reward out there?
Well, we believe that someone has probably talked by now. It's been several years, and generally, people either they drink too much or they get in a jam or.
Uh-huh.
Something come a crisis in their life, and they start talking to someone, and we're hoping that someone has heard from the suspect about what occurred, and that person can give us a call, and we're hoping that that $50,000 reward will help generate that and give us some solid leads to go on here.
And how was the in terms of forensics, what do you have that you know, is out there that you can say publicly.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have the phone log of his phone, and of course we know that he was calling his mother Nancy as he was walking home, and something concerned him because he was very concerned and upset. When he last called her, she went to pick him up at that location, which is probably only about 200 feet, maybe 250 feet where he was found. And but it was off the road, so it would have been very hard to see from the roadway. So we don't have anything as far as a killer's identity, a weapon, any kind of DNA evidence from anyone other than the victim himself. So we have a pretty good idea what happened. His shoes were found in the intersection diagonally across from where he last called to the point where he was found. They were like flip-flops, and we presume that he ran. He was running from someone, and he lost his shoes in the middle of the roadway. But we just don't have anything solid as to a suspect.
Mr. and Mrs. Ross?
Yes.
Mr. and Mrs. Ross, question for you. You hired a private investigator. What year did you hire the private investigator, and was he or she able to glean anything from his investigation?
Well, we've actually had a couple of private investigators right after Joey was murdered. We got the help of one, and, they more or less just take the lead from you. Will you go talk to this person? Will you go talk to that person? And then more recently, about a year and a half ago, we had a different one work on it, and it was kind of the same thing, just kind of tracking leads down and some information and rumors that were coming out of the jail from time to time. So just kind of that sort of thing. At the time of the reward and the time that, when the billboard went up, prior to that, we did an initial passing out of flyers again. We did it right after his death, and then we did it again a couple years after and got a few more, leads in, and they were followed up by the private investigator, but nothing really substantive.
And can I ask you if you can answer what state that Steve Olives is in now, if you could say the state at all?
I believe he's still in California, about 45 minutes from here.
Oh, okay.
Lieutenant, if you can tell us, was there anything in regard to the manner of death and the assault on Joey to indicate if it was especially violent, if there were a lot of stab wounds or just one fatal wound? Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, that information had already been released. There was three major stab wounds and then some other defensive wounds. And the area where he ran to was a carport, but there was a gate there and then a fence behind that in the backyard. So it was a bad location to end up with someone chasing you with a weapon, because he would take him a while to get over the fence, and then once he got in the backyard, he would have been trapped by an even higher fence. So,
but it was the home of a friend of his. His friend lived over the garage in the garage apartment, and I believe he was probably trying to get to him.
Right, and that's a reasonable conclusion.
Yeah.
Is there any reason to think that there was more than one assailant? Is there any evidence or any reason that you would think there was more than one person involved?
There's not. And again, when it comes to any forensics at the crime scene, we have nothing on the assailant. That's really the big question mark, that if we could just get some good direction on a suspect.
Okay, I'm going to, we have this... the same caller back, and I'm going to try one more time.
All right.
Caller from 602, first three numbers, are you with us this time?
Yes.
Okay, please welcome to the show, and what is your question or comment?
I'm just listening because I was a good friend of Joey's, and I just want to know more about what's going on.
Okay. Do you have any information for us that might help the police to solve this case?
I don't.
Okay. You're welcome. Certainly stay on the line and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lieutenant, if someone has information that new leads or fresh leads, who should they contact, and can they make an anonymous report?
Yes, they may. They should contact either myself or Sergeant Joe Johnson at the Oakdale Police Department, and the number is area code 209-847-2231. My direct line is 209-845-3511, and they can either leave an anonymous tip or give us their name, however they would choose to handle that.
Lieutenant, we frequently talk on this program on the various cases we cover about solvability factors or probabilities. Do you think this case, it seems like it should be solvable. Do you share that optimism?
I would think that at some point in time we will probably get that piece of information that leads us to the suspect. We have a pretty good idea of what happened just for the fact that Joey was making phone calls and what evidence we found at the scene. The big question mark is who was involved, and we've had many people give us many different names and have looked into that. We've even had a cold case detective go through the whole case a couple of years ago from the district attorney's office, or actually, I believe it's district attorney's office, and they came to the same dead end that we did. A lot of information, but a lot of it's just hearsay that comes back to a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
We also wanted to say that his family has a website for anonymous tips too. That it's joyrosstips.com.
And how long has that website been up? Has it been up for a while now? Or?
Yeah, it has.
That's all one word, Nancy? Joey Ross?
Yeah.
Yep.
Joyrosstips.com.
Okay. And, Lieutenant, one thing just came to mind here. You indicated earlier that Steve and Joey apparently left at slightly different times. Do you recall who went first, left the bar first?
According to Olives, I believe he said that he left first, and he went to the apartment that they shared, that was Joey's apartment, and waited for Joey.
He was meeting a girl.
Yes, a girl met him at that
After
he got to the apartment.
And she indicated that Steve was very nervous the whole time they were together and kept looking out the window, kept pacing, you know.
Do you know about how long the time gap was between when Steve left and when Joey left the bar?
We do not, because we weren't able to capture either one of them on any video in that general area. So we're pretty much going with there was also security video that the Rosses had inside
the bar.
The bar itself.
Yeah.
And that showed that the two of them were there for some time. And then the last bit of it was just Joey there. So that seemed to corroborate what Olive said, that he left first and then Joseph followed afterwards.
There was some indication, too, that they might have had a fight or an argument.
Steve and Joey might have had an argument?
Uh-huh. Before or sometime during the night.
Would they have, to get to the apartment, would they more than likely have taken the same route?
Probably, but it was very out of character for Joey to walk anywhere alone. And when he did come, he always started down
Poplar,
not down the highway. He never went down the highway.
Okay, well, listen, we ran out of time. It's really a frustrating case, because I think everyone who spoke tonight agrees that someone by this time has probably talked to somebody. Somebody must know something.
Well, that's
what
we're hoping.
And we certainly want to encourage you, if you have information, you know, it's time to share it. Give Lieutenant Jenkins a call. Go to Joey's website. But get it out there. Share your information with someone. And, you know, let's get this thing resolved. Joey needs justice. His family needs justice. And if you've got the information, and, of course, there is the $50,000 reward to be considered in addition to doing the right thing. I want to thank our guests, the Rosses and Lieutenant Jenkins, very much for being with us.
Oh,
and,
thank you so much.
Well, thank you
if there's
for
any changes or developments in the case or anything else we can do. We'd be happy to have you back on again, and we'll certainly update the case if there's any new information.
Well, we appreciate that.
That'd be great.
Can I jump in, Denny? I'd like to do a special thanks to Marty West, Chief of Police for Oakdale Police Department, for allowing Lieutenant Jenkins to participate in the show tonight.
Okay, thank you very much, folks, and don't forget, keep in touch, huh?
Okay, very
thank
good.
All right.
Bye-bye. Good luck.
Okay, our next case tonight, the Luis Padilla case. Luis Padilla, age 51, failed to report to work at the Hampton Inn in Bowie, Maryland, on January the 5th, 2008. The next day, January 6th, Luis's boss contacted the Anne Arundel County Police and asked them to check on Luis at his home in Crofton. At 1:53 that afternoon, Luis was found dead in his residence of a gunshot wound behind his right ear. At 2:35, 42 minutes later, the crime scene unit was dispatched to a, quote, suicide at that location. The CSU, the crime scene unit, collected the gun case, bullets, a bullet casing, an alleged suicide note, and a pad of paper. They did not conduct any further tests or examinations, and none were requested. However, Luis's family believes the conclusion that Luis killed himself was based on an inadequate investigation and that his death was in fact a homicide. With us tonight to explain why they don't agree with the suicide ruling are Luis's sister, Margaret Padilla, and his friend, Alicia Morris. Welcome to Crime Wire, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go right to Alicia. Let's go to Alicia Morris instead. Alicia, fill in the blanks here with anything that I missed in my opening commentary. You've done extensive research on this. You've done an amazing job of going into so many different avenues that you've learned. I say many times on these shows, unfortunately, and I do mean unfortunately, the survivors, the friends of the victims, all of a sudden become authorities by all their things that they look into to try to help on the case. What do you feel in this case?
Well, your opening was correct as far as the time. The police decided in 42 minutes that it was a suicide when they called the crime scene unit. And they collected absolutely no additional evidence from this case. The house was not sealed. And they have continually refused to look at any further information. They keep saying the case is closed. It was a suicide. There was a supposed suicide note found taped to Lewis's chest. And the first time Margaret and I both saw the note, I can tell you it's not Lewis's writing. Margaret hired a private handwriting analyst to look at the note along with other samples of Lewis's writing. She concluded that he did not write the note. The police never gathered any samples of Lewis's handwriting for comparison, and when we offered samples to them, they refused to take them. One of the officers, when we tried to show it to him, said, "It looks the same to me. Besides, the note was written in a felt tip marker." That's the kind of attitude we've been up against since the beginning.
Well, okay. Now, you've hired...
Can I interject something here?
Yes.
He also mentioned that anybody could be paid to say anything.
Exactly.
So he just kind of minimized the importance of the report that was given by ABC graphology expert.
Well, they did. What that statement was made to me and to another friend of Margaret's in a meeting. They knew about the handwriting analyst because she had gone there to try to get the original note. She was looking at a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And the officer said to us, well, you can't pay too much attention to what they say because they can be paid to say whatever you want them to.
Yes.
And she was very careful to be paid up front so that there wouldn't be any sense of impropriety.
Right.
Alicia, why don't you tell our listeners across the country a little bit about who else you spoke with, who is a very famous retired lieutenant commander of New York City Police Department.
Yes. Well, as part of my research, I found a quote from Lieutenant Commander Vernon Gebbers, and I apologize if I'm not pronouncing his name correctly.
You got it right.
But his quote was, it was regarding another case, but the quote was, people don't commit suicide by putting a gun behind their head. People who are shot behind the ear are usually executed. So I wrote a letter to Commander Gebbers, and I told him what the police had done regarding this investigation, what they hadn't done. And God bless him, he called me, and he did speak with me. And he basically agreed with me that this was not a suicide, but he couldn't do any investigation in Maryland. But he,
you know, you would think that the police department, you know, I've spoken places with this Vernon Gebbert, and I mean, he retired. He was the commanding officer of the Bronx Homicide Task Force.
Yes.
Which handled 400 murder investigations a year. Okay, a year we're talking about.
Right.
To do 400 in an entire career would be an unbelievable amount.
I believe it was approximately 5,000 death investigations.
Right. I mean, you would think the police would pay a little bit more attention to that, where you bring in a handwriting expert, number one. You have conversations with Vernon. And everything's pointing to this is not a suicide. Am I correct?
Yes. They didn't know about Commander Gebbers through this. We've got a new officer working on this case now, and I just sent him my documentation, which includes the information about Commander Gebbers as well as his credentials. So hopefully he'll pay a little more attention to it.
Yeah,
I've got to interject
something. You know, I've also talked with that same investigator, and I did promise him that I would give the. I asked him about the case, and he gave me five reasons why he believed it was suicide, and I promised him I would give them. And I believe Alicia has some information to add to that, or point counterpoint type thing. But anyway, he says the apartment was neat and orderly, no signs of foul play. The note that was written, the fact that Luis bought a gun 2 to 3 weeks prior to his death, and that he was being treated for depression with no prescription visible via testing in his blood, and that there was no motive for anybody to shoot him, to kill him. Well, that's all, you know, I have to say about that. And Alicia, maybe you can give your counterpoint.
Yes, Gene, after you told me that, I wrote a letter to Sergeant Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the condo being orderly and no signs of foul play, yes, the condo was orderly, but the room he was found in was a mess. He was laying on a bed, and there were 4 or 5 covers thrown on the bed. There were electric cords scattered on the floor and a pair of shoes that looked like they had either been just tossed off or thrown in the room. And the closet door in that room was open. The window screen in that room was pulled out from the outside and on the ground under the window. And He was last seen leaving work the Thursday night before this, and he had his briefcase with him. And that briefcase, along with several other items from the condo, are missing. Now, the police counter that by saying that we can't verify the missing items. But he carried a briefcase with him every day. He had it Thursday, and it was not in his condo. As far as the suicide note, I've already said that the note didn't match his writing.
Right.
We found an envelope on a shelf in the living room that had some papers from the hotel that Lewis had written on the front, "Do not remove," and then his signature. The suicide note said, "Do not save me," and his signature. And the pad of paper from the CSU report, they say that they found the pad of paper, but the note, the corner, the left corner of the page was torn, and it didn't say whether there was a ragged edge left on that pad of paper. There was no writing instrument found. And it's, you know, to me, it's, if you write a note and leave the pad of paper out, it seems you would set the pen down beside it. But there was no pen ever found. It was a felt tip marker. We found a couple in his condo, but they were both dried out. Now, they said he bought the gun 2 to 3 weeks before he died, and I have the exact quote here. Of course, you know I can't. Oh, okay, here we go. The gun was purchased on December 6th and picked up on December 29th. Now, after Lewis was found, a neighbor told one of the police officers that he had noticed that the screen in the master bedroom, Lewis was found in the spare bedroom in the back of the condo. The master bedroom was in the front of the condo, and one corner of the screen had been pulled out like someone was trying to get it out of the window. And the time that he said he found that roughly corresponds to the time that he bought the gun. But the officer told that neighbor that the screen had nothing to do with his death. Now, as far as being treated for seasonal affective disorder, I was working with Lewis when he was first diagnosed with that, and he didn't take the Wellbutrin every day. Lewis is like everybody else that suffers from SAD. Some days are worse than others, and he would take it on the days that he felt really bad. And I know this because we discussed it. And he used one of those lights, they call them happy lights, more often than he used the medication. As far as no motive, Lewis told Margaret in October that he was afraid for his safety. The investigators never interviewed any of his friends or coworkers, and the couple of men that Lewis met through his salsa dance group wanted him to invest in a couple of businesses, but Lewis found out these weren't men that he wanted to be associated with and backed out, and they were not happy. A friend of his told Margaret that he went out to dinner at a Baltimore club with a friend and was very nervous about someone who was there. And he also supposedly had an argument with several men outside a Baltimore club a few days before he died. And as far as I'm concerned, legally, a motive is not required.
Alicia, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Sure.
And then Margaret, certainly chime in if you have any comments you'd like to make. I'm looking at a timeline here, and I see that on January 3rd, Luis left work and went to the gym. I assume that other people saw him at the gym. When, to your knowledge, was the last time there was an eyewitness that Luis was alive? When was he last seen by anyone?
He was seen on the elevator at 3:45 with his briefcase on Thursday.
3:45 on Thursday, seen by what? Other people in the building, I assume?
At the building at the Census Bureau.
Okay, on January 4th, 2008, Luis should have worked from 8 to 4:30 p.m. at the Census Bureau. However, he called work after 8 a.m. and said he was not feeling well and would not be coming in. He
right.
said he would see them tomorrow, which would have been a Saturday, and they didn't work on Saturdays, on weekends.
Right.
Now, there's some speculation, I believe, by you that perhaps he was already in trouble and was using this phone call. First of all, by whoever he was in trouble with was present and wanted him to make this call so no one would come snooping around wondering why he wasn't at work.
Right.
So I'm wondering, was there an autopsy done, or what is being used as the date and time of death? Was there an autopsy that pinned it down, or are they using the time the body was discovered on the 5th at 1:35 p.m.?
Margaret, you can speak to this as far as the medical examiner. Margaret asked, did you ask her, Margaret, or did she just tell you?
No, the time of death was when he was, they ruled time of death and when he was found. That
yeah,
she said whenever they brought the body there. I called her the next morning on that Monday, and she said it had been at least 12 hours. She couldn't give me an exact time of death.
Mm-hmm. So it could have been sometime on the 4th, or it could have been on the 5th. We just don't know.
Right.
It happened between Friday through Sunday. I feel that the way he made that phone call at 9:20 a.m. to work, and because of what he said, he was in trouble then. He was not alone.
Now, would it be in Luis's character to call in sick, if you will, an hour and 20 minutes after he should have been on the job?
No.
Do you know it was?
Yeah. So I know that.
Is it confirmed that it was his voice? Did he leave it on a recording, or did he speak to a supervisor?
He spoke to a coworker.
Coworker.
Yes.
Okay.
And to me, it would be odd that he would call. He was always very conscientious. When you call in sick, you're going to do it around the time that you should be there, because that work environment was such. After a certain time, everybody started wondering, okay, where is this person, and do we need to check on them?
Uh-huh.
And the fact that he said, I'm going to lay around all day, Lewis would not tell a coworker that. And I say that because the person he spoke to was a coworker, not necessarily a friend. I think if he had called and perhaps spoken to me, and I wasn't working at this time, I've been retired for a while,
uh-huh.
I think he would have maybe told me that, but not anyone else in the office.
Okay.
And the fact that he said, I'll see you tomorrow, I don't believe for a minute that he forgot that it was Friday. I think that's where he was trying to perhaps let somebody know something wasn't exactly right. But this is just supposition on my part.
This is Tom Shamshak. Can I go back to the a couple of forensics questions? Did the family think of hiring its own forensic pathologist to review the results and maybe to get the pathologist to look at the crime scene photos? Or, you know, has that offer been made to the police for that request, rather?
No, but we're considering that now.
I'm sure we could help you, give you some names of people in the area down there to reach out to. But again, there are a lot of forensics around this case that need to be methodically explored. I read someplace that the weapon was in his hand on
yes.
his lap.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know if they took a dowel and really reconstructed the direction of the projectile? What are the terminal circumstances of the crime scene? What do they look like? And perhaps you're not going to get to look at that, but certainly a professional medical legal expert would be. It should be granted. I mean, I'll defer to Vito and Denny on that, but in my humble opinion, that should be a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
Vito or Denny, want to chime in?
Tom, this is Gene again. The autopsy report, there's this statement that the wound path, he describes the wound path, and they also talk about no soot.
No spatter?
That there was soot at the edges of the entrance of the wound. But yet, the picture of him holding the gun, there was no soot on his hand.
Can I say something right there?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Margaret. Anyway,
sure.
I had asked the examiner, Dr. Lee, about any gun residue, any gunpowder on his hand, and she did tell me that there was no, to the visible eye, there was no gunpowder on him, no residue or anything. But the police says, well, she doesn't check for that. And we argued with the investigators over that.
Well, Sergeant Clark hangs his hat on the fact that they test for stippling?
Stippling. But see, Sergeant Clark just got involved now. Sergeant Clark. Yes.
Yeah, and there's a section on page 28 of the document you sent me, Alicia, that says, I do not believe, based on the information, that the gun was held to Lewis's head. I believe instead that it was held close to his head. If you consider the wound path right to left, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it ends up, it makes more sense that someone else fired that gun and it did not result in a contact wound.
You know, Tom, who made that comment?
I don't know.
About the wound path and all?
Yeah.
I did.
Oh, okay.
I went out and bought a book called, when I first started this research, I did it to try to get some answers because the pieces didn't fit for me.
Uh-huh.
So when I started this, I had no idea what answers I was going to get. And this book, Forensics for Dummies, had diagrams of what gunshot wounds look like based on the distance that the gun is from the wound. And to me, what I read and what I saw, and I also looked at a lot of pictures of gunshot wounds to the head, the wound looked more like it was held, I believe, up to 6 inches from his head. Plus, with the wound path from right to left, front to back, and slightly downward, does not make sense that he would, the bullet should have gone straight if he had shot himself. And the only way I can explain it is if you put your finger behind your ear up near the top of it, and if you point your finger, when you first start out, your elbow's down. If you point your finger, it's already left, right to left, slightly right to left, front to back, and slightly downward. Your elbow ends up in the air. And when I first started this, I had spoken with a Maryland State police officer to find out about guns and gunshot wounds. So the path of the bullet suggests that if his finger was on the trigger, he could not have shot himself that way. We had a former sheriff tell us that with that wound path, it would make more sense for his thumb to be on the trigger than his finger.
You had to be sitting up.
Yeah, he was in a mostly prone position. He was laying down on pillows. And the bed was a mess. None of the blankets were straight. The pillowcases were all askew. So,
Alicia, you know, my best advice is that you get a forensic pathologist to look at the documentary evidence and to review the crime scene photos. You really have to begin to look at the blood spatter, and again, that's what I would recommend that the family do.
There was no blood splatter, by the way. There was no exit wound.
Okay.
And there wasn't any blood splatter on his hand.
No, there wasn't.
Hey, Tom?
Yes. Yep.
I agree with you 100%, 1,000% about the expert. The only problem I see with this case, it just seems that the police department, you brought in a handwriting expert, you got Vernon Gilbert, that makes his opinion. You got other things that jump out at you. You got this guy that wanted Luis to give him money for an investment. Okay, you got Margaret finds a note on her windshield that says "Let it go or you'll be next." Number three, you got people coming to house or people calling wanting to see Luis's bank statements. You got people saying they were representing the Padilla family. Then you got another guy that comes to a house. He wants to go through the house because his former roommate used to live there, and he leaves with a box of stuff. So, unfortunately, I think what I'm hearing from this police department, I don't think even if you had Dr. Michael Bodden or Dr. Larry Kobolinski come in and do yeoman's work on this and give their opinion in their written statements, I don't even know if the police are going to jump at that, Tom. That's just my opinion.
Well, you know, I'll concede that it sounds like there's some, incompetence and mediocrity associated with the investigation. I think the family needs to go to, the political route
We went to Congress and we tried to go through the FBI. They said he wasn't murdered or he didn't die on the job, so they couldn't help us.
And the local politicians defer to the police.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we've run up against.
Have you folks got an investigative reporter at any local newspaper or TV or radio station there that might have an interest in this?
Well, one, the Baltimore Sun did run an article, but the article ended up very biased for the police. Now, I called them and invited them to listen to this show tonight. Hopefully they did. I called the Baltimore Sun, the Washington Post, and our local Channel 7 News. Those were the most favorable responses I got when I contacted various media.
And let me tell you this also, that this show, all our shows, are archived, and within a half hour of the end of this program, it will be archived right on our website and the Blog Talk Radio website. So if they didn't, or anybody who didn't get a chance to listen to it live, can certainly listen to it and play back from the archives. And, you know, my thought, and then we'll see what Vito and Gene and Tom think, but my thought is that there are enough points raised here that, maybe there are explanations, but to just poo-poo a handwriting expert and say, well, this person could have been paid, a hired gun type thing. That the fact that the screens, one screen showed it had shown some evidence that perhaps someone had tried to remove it. The other screen in the spare bedroom was actually out. That Lewis had indicated he needed a gun for personal protection because he felt his life was in danger. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that I think raise certainly questions that perhaps should be addressed. And maybe they can all be explained away. Maybe there are reasonable explanations. But I don't think he's gotten those explanations up to this point. And, it just seems like you should get answers. The family should get answers.
Yep.
When I got back in February, we noticed that the room that he was found in, the windows were unlocked.
Oh, that's right.
And
the kitchen windows were locked.
Yeah. And the master room were also unlocked.
Well, there was an expensive guitar taken, too, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. Yes.
Yeah.
And his camera and some jewelry.
Yes,
but there was no foul play.
Well, they said that nobody can say for sure what was in the condo. But I certainly can say his briefcase should have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was seen with that on Thursday night, the night before this kind of mysterious sick call-in phone call to the Census Bureau.
Right.
Also, we found, and I never thought of keeping it, he had an old briefcase that belonged to my father, a Samsonite one, the old hard ones, and it was somebody forced it open, and it was empty. Now, that's not like Lewis to leave a briefcase in the car, in the trunk of the car, empty.
Yeah.
And I never thought of giving it to the police. I just grabbed it and threw it away.
Well, with the time is gone on us. We're down to our last few seconds. I want to thank both of you, Alicia and Margaret, for being with us tonight. And please keep in touch with us. Let us know if there's anything we can do or if anything changes in regard to the investigation. We would certainly do a follow-up show or assist you in any way we can. So thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for listening to us.
Keep in contact with me, Alicia, and Margaret, and I'll pass whatever you want on to the CrimeWire team.
Okay.
We will. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you all so much for listening to us.
You're welcome.
And have a good
thank
evening.
And I want to thank the CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be on Tuesday, March 29th, 2011. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
This is Tom. Thank you all for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Again, to hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume of your computer, and the show will play automatically.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.